Welcome to the Saturday Slammin' Jam, hosted by Andrew Schlecht with Alex Spears.
How about we can just watch basketball?
That's a man's jam!
I like that idea.
Live from Oklahoma.
Quick clip!
With questions and participants from all around the world.
Anthony Edwards!
Put that on a poster!
Whether you're flipping your flapjacks, tending to your yard, or just sipping your coffee, get ready, sit back, relax. It's the Saturday Slammin' Jam.
Fact is, I missed this shot. I'll walk away. I'm still a chump.
Here's Andrew.
Welcome to the Saturday Slammin' Jam. I'm your host, Andrew Schlecht. Go to theathletic.com/NBA show and get The Athletic for $1 a month for 6 months. It's the playoffs. We're in the middle of a pretty tasty first round, and you need to go get yourself an Athletic subscription. With me, as always, is my good friend Alex Spears. And Alex, we're joined by Nikias Duncan. He's a writer at basketballnews.com and a co-host of the Dunker Spot podcast. Nikias, what's up, man?
Hello, hello. How are y'all?
Doing good. Thanks for joining, man. Really looking forward to this. Been looking forward to it for the last few days. After a week of playoff basketball, what series or team, or player even, has surprised you the most compared to how you were feeling going into the playoffs?
I would say very impressed with what Tyrese Maxey has been able to do. I think I'm tied with Tyrese Maxey and Tobias Harris. And more so Tobias Harris, because he was someone that I pinpointed in this Raptors Sixers series. And for full transparency, I picked Raptors in seven before the series. I am going to be taking a big L on that one, so that's fun. but one of the things I was concerned about in regards to fielding was like, okay, how decisive is Tobias Harris going to be? Because Toronto is going to switch a ton. That's going to flatten out some of what Philly wants to do in the offense. And in terms of Joel Embiid, they're going to send a bunch of double teams towards him. They're going to shade a bunch of help towards him. So a lot of the kickouts are going to go to Tobias Harris. We know he can shoot. We know he can score. But he also has this tendency throughout his career to where he'll catch it, hold it, survey the floor, and now whatever advantage was created is going to be gone. So I was kind of keeping an eye on, like, okay, how quick is he going to shoot? How quick is he going to drive? And he's been nailing that stuff through three games of the series. So I've been super impressed with that. And once you have that going with Tyrese Maxey losing his mind and Joel Embiid being dominant, Toronto hasn't really had a great answer to slow down everyone.
Mm-hmm. So the Sixers went up 3-0 on the Raptors this week in very dramatic fashion with Joel Embiid hitting that game-winning three in overtime. And one of the major questions coming into the playoffs was the play of James Harden, who had a really disappointing end of the regular season. And through three games, Harden's scoring remains down, but Philly hasn't really needed his scoring with the way that Maxey and Tobias, as you just mentioned, have played. How do you think Harden has looked so far in this playoffs?
He's looked pretty solid to me. The scoring still isn't where you would like it to be, but I've also just been kind of confused by Toronto's plan with him because one of the biggest reasons I picked Toronto to win the series, like, I'm not sure how healthy James Harden is going to be. I feel like I kind of undersold what the week of rest would do for him in the early portion of the series, but I was just like, okay, this is what he's looked like. The burst hasn't been there. The rim attempts have looked bad. It's been a lot of him getting to, even when he does get to the rim, it's flailing the arms and trying to draw fouls versus trying to convert. And I was really concerned. And through the first 2.5 games of the series, at least, Toronto's sending aggressive help towards him on drives. And it's just playing into his hand as a playmaker. I'm just like, why are you making life easier for Harden? Like, he hasn't really answered the question for me. But with the way that he's been defended up until like the second half of game three, he hasn't had to answer that because Toronto is just gifting him kickouts. And again, that goes back into Tyrese Maxey attacking closeouts and bombing away from three. Tobias Harris doing that. Danny Green knocking down timely shots. And so Harden has kind of taken what the Raptors have given him. They did shift their plan in game three where it was more single coverage. And he's been able to beat Gary Trent Jr. off the dribble. He's been able to beat Fred VanVleet off the dribble, and Fred is really laboring out there with the knee. That's concerning. The minute load is really caught up to him. But I would say it's been a B series, B plus series for James Harden. Like, you want the scoring to be better, but he's done his job otherwise.
So we're going to jump around to a few different series, and I want to go next to the Jazz Mavs because we were recording on Friday. It's the day after Utah lost to Dallas at home to go down 1-2 in that series. And it was a familiar scene because Dallas hit 18 threes. They outscored Utah by 27 points from beyond the three-point line. During that game, Rudy Gobert got into foul trouble. Snyder opted to go small with Eric Pascal. Utah made a run and were a +9 during his minutes. Do you think Utah potentially found something with that small lineup, or was it more of a product of Maxi Kleba and Dwight Powell also being in foul trouble at the same time?
I think it's more of the latter. I will say, if Dallas is going to be this comfortable switching and flattening out Utah's offense, and if we're going to get the combination of Rudy Gobert not sealing his man or his guards just not looking at him, sometimes both things happen on the same possession, then you might as well have a guy that can theoretically shoot out there. Like, I can see the argument for going smaller in that regard. But also, like, I don't really trust Eric Pascal in this series. Like, I don't think that's going to be something that you can depend on. Like, I think the solution, if Utah's to get back into the series, is to figure out the Rudy Gobert thing on both ends of the floor. As my co-host Steve Jones Jr. referenced on our last episode, like, Dallas is not only putting him in tough help positions, they're now moving him around the chessboard. His guy's in the corner sometimes, his guy's in the wing sometimes. And now it's, okay, am I supposed to help? If I do help, do I trust the guys behind me to rotate behind that? And it's just been a whole bunch of confusion there. So I think they need to tighten up their rotations more than anything. It was nice for them to get the bump with Eric Pascal out there. They've needed to find a small ball unit all year long. And so if that does become a thing, that's a positive for you. But ultimately, I think the issue is more so with the starters. Like, they need to figure that out.
And that kind of leads into my next question, because I saw something in that game that I didn't actually believe I was seeing until someone else mentioned it. It was Dan Clayton, who's a writer at Salt City Hoops. He tweeted during the game that what was most frustrating to him about the Jazz is that their terrible perimeter defense seemed to magically improve when Gobert or Whiteside were not on the floor. Dallas was still scoring, but you weren't seeing blow-bys on every single play. How do you explain that? Because are the perimeter defenders really incapable of playing defense, or is it like a byproduct of a scheme thing where they've been used to funneling opponents to Gobert, and so then they forget how to play defense when he's on the court? Like, what is it?
Like, I think it's more so on the perimeter defenders. I think Rudy and Hassan Whiteside complicate things, because as Dallas spaces those guys to the corner and they're not able to comfortably help around the rim, I think that force, again, that kind of triggers the rotations behind it. And the rotations, I feel like, have been worse than whatever Rudy's doing. Because you can kind of argue, like, there was a possession in game two that I pointed out and wrote about where he helps down on a drive, but he's helping down from the strong side corner. And that's typically a big no-no for NBA defenses, because you're leaving a shooter there. It's just a more open look for the offense. And so you have those where it's like, okay, Rudy, I understand why you're helping down, but you shouldn't have based on the scheme. But ultimately, I don't want to be redundant, but it's just a mess right now. Like, I think it's a lot of it is just like, Donovan Mitchell, as good of a player as he is, he has been beaten like a drum this entire series.
Yeah.
And so you don't have to get to, hey, should Hassan help here? Should Rudy Gobert help here? If he could contain the ball, to a lesser extent, that's Mike Conley. Daniel House, for him to be dubbed as a 3-and-D guy in Houston, how many lapses is this dude going to have? Mm-hmm. And he isn't doing a great job containing the ball either. And then you have poor Royce O'Neal, who's their best perimeter defender. You put him on a guard, that's not his ministry. And so everything is just kind of in flux from the top. And now you're asking these big men, like Rudy Gobert, again, one of the best defense players in the league, he's in tough spots. So if he can't figure it out, you probably shouldn't expect Hassan Whiteside to do that when he's pretty much a drop defender or bust, and has been since his Miami days. So I still lean more towards the perimeter defense being a mess.
So in that respect, is it unsolvable? Like, is this really a fatal flaw that they just will not be able, that they just cannot adjust to in any way?
Like, I don't know if there's a scheme fix for it, because Utah has gotten switchier as the series has gone on, because Dallas is not even, and this is another thing that my co-host Steve Jones Jr. said, Dallas isn't even running like intricate sets anymore. It's just, all right, let's get a high screen. We're going to force a mismatch, and then we're just going to drive past this dude and see where the help's going to come from, and then we'll play out of that. And so it really just, again, it's going to sound a little reductive, it really is just going to boil down to playing better. Like, they just have to tighten up the containment, and if they can't do that, at the very least, tighten up the rotations. Know which guy is dropping down, who's zoning up behind that, who's Xing out behind that. Like, that can come with film, and this core has played together long enough to where they should be able to figure that out. So, like, it isn't completely dead. There is a fix. Again, it's just playing better. My faith level in Utah is done. I've seen enough. Like, I headed into the postseason. I was going to pick Dallas in 7. And then the Luka Doncic news dropped. And I was like, okay, well, I'm going Utah in six. If they're not going to have Luka, I think they'll be able to figure this out. And now Dallas is up 2-1. And they have all the momentum, it looks like. Utah has been throwing up all over themselves for three games. I don't need to see anymore.
Yeah. It was like very much a vibe check for me with Utah before I picking the series. Like, do I really believe in this Utah team? Like, that's what it came down to. Even though it was like going to be a Jalen Brunson-led Dallas team, there was just something about it. I was like, I guess I trust that a little bit more, which seems weird. Like, it just doesn't seem, it doesn't seem right. Let's bounce over to this suddenly interesting Bucks-Bulls series. We learned this week that Chris Middleton is out for the rest of the Bucks' first round series against the Bulls with the sprained MCL. In your playoff preview, you had pinpointed Middleton's offense and how he'd respond to pesky defenders as the key thing to watch for now. Now that they don't have Middleton anymore, and per cleaning the glass in the first two games against Chicago, Milwaukee scored 81 points per 100 possessions in the half court, which is worst among playoff teams. Do you think the Bulls should now be favored in this series, or do you still have confidence that the Bucks can figure something out when they were already struggling with Middleton in the lineup?
I definitely understand the case for favoring Chicago at this point, especially what we saw in their most recent game. I would still lean towards my Milwaukee in this one. They do still have Giannis, and Giannis had an uncharacteristically bad defensive showing in game two. I don't think we see that again. And as far as Milwaukee's half-court offense goes, a lot of that is process stuff. And this is stuff that annoyed me during the playoff run last year. It's like, okay, why? There was a play that I did a breakdown on my timeline. It's like, okay, you're posting up Giannis. You run a good set and get him an advantage on the left block. Why is Javon Carter one pass away? If you know,
I saw your screenshot of that. It was like, yeah.
I'm just like, if you know Chicago is going to double team anytime Giannis gets a post up or an ISO, and credit to Chicago because they have been nailing the double teams. Sometimes it's coming right on the catch. Sometimes it's coming right on the move. They're rotating behind it. They're forcing turnover. Chicago did their job in game two. But if you know this is the game plan for Chicago, why are you putting your worst shooter directly beside your star and making it easier for you to double team? And this is a lot of what Milwaukee did last year until they finally figured it out towards the end of the Nets series. And then in the finals, they were able to just kind of get it rolling. I was hoping that that latter portion of the playoff run would just kind of carry over. And through two games, they've been kind of a mess on offense. So I do think there's enough low-hanging fruit there. They will either start Bobby Portis or they'll start one of their smaller guards. So the spacing, I don't think, is going to take too much of a dip. You're going to miss that shot creation. But if they just space their players in a better way, Giannis should still be able to have his way in this series. Like, I still would pick Milwaukee to win it, but it's really going to boil down to their process. Like, are they going to do smart things and put their best player in position to succeed?
Let's bounce over to Boston, Brooklyn. The Nets are down 0-2 in the series, but it's taken a last second shot and uncharacteristically bad games from KD and Kyrie to get there. Brian Lewis from the New York Post noted that this is the first time in KD's career that he shot under 40% and committed 6+ turnovers in consecutive games. When a team is guarding KD as effectively as Boston has been, what is the counter? Like, how can Nash help get KD going in game three? Or is it just a matter of him making his shots? Because I went back and rewatched those 17 attempts from game two. Yes, there weren't a lot of easy attempts, but there were also a lot of shots you'd normally expect KD to make.
Honestly, I feel like this is more of a KD thing than a Nash thing.
Okay.
It's as ISO heavy as the Nets can get. It's not like their offense is inbound the ball, walk up, isolation for the next 20 seconds. Like, they're not doing that. They are running a lot of their usual sets. Like, they're running the scissor stuff with KD and Kyrie. They're running KD from the baseline, receiving a screen. Like, they are running, they are doing things with KD. Boston is doing a fantastic job of being physical early. And then when KD is making this move, they're being physical when they switch. It's not just a soft switch. They are bumping him as they switch to Simon, so he can't really get a crease. And then when he does get the ball, they're showing help early at the nail, like they're restricting space from there. And so I feel like there are, with the way that Boston is helping on these KD actions, there are avenues for kickouts for KD that he missed a ton of in game two. He missed some in game one as well. But in game two, it was pretty egregious. And the same thing for Kyrie. Like, there were a lot of contested shots that he took with Seth Curry chilling on the wing wide open with Bruce Brown, which that's more so by design, but Bruce Brown's open in the corner. And Bruce Brown had a good shooting game in game two. Like, you don't want to ride the high end of that green, like, hey, take 13 threes for us. But if it's a Bruce Brown corner three versus Kyrie attacking a drop with a guy helping from the strong side and a guy at the nail, and it's basically three guys in the area contesting the shot, like, yeah, swing that to Bruce Brown, see if he can knock down another shot or drive, since he's been so much of a short role monster for them this season. Make life easier for yourself. Like, I feel like this is on the players to execute, trust their guys, read the floor better, more so than Nash just, like, sitting on his hands.
Right. Okay.
Let's move over to Phoenix, New Orleans, where we have just more devastating news. Devin Booker, who could miss up to 2 to 3 weeks with a hamstring strain. Cam Johnson is expected to start in his place, and you wrote an article on basketballnews.com detailing how Phoenix attacked New Orleans after Booker went out, much of it coming off of ball screens from Chris Paul. Outside of Chris, who on the Suns do you think is most critical to their success with Booker out against the Pelicans?
I think this is going to go to Cam Johnson, who's probably going to replace Booker in a lot of the pick and roll sets that they run. He's a very good movement shooter. He's not going to be Devin Booker, but at the very least, he can still stress your defense in that way. And it's going to be a DeAndre Ayton. Like, I think he's going to be the guy that's really going to force New Orleans to change their defensive coverage. Because we did see more switching from Larry Nance Jr. when they went small. And when JV was in the game, they went from the drop with him to now basically blitzing ball screens with him. And so it's going to be up to Ayton if he does get switches. And they're going to switch Larry Nance Jr. out onto Chris Paul or whatever. He's going to have to mash those guys down low, get to the line, convert it to rim. And if they're going to play high, he's going to have to nail some short roll decisions. I think there was a clip in the article that you referenced in which they did show how with JV, you get a short roll pass to DeAndre Ayton and he kicks it out to Cam Johnson for a corner and for a three in the right corner. And so he has to nail those things. And from there, like, I think Phoenix still has enough to be able to kind of bend New Orleans' defense, and they should be okay.
Mm-hmm. So this is a non-playoff question, but it was just announced. We're recording on Friday morning, so I thought I'd get your thoughts. We learned today that James Borrego has been fired by the Charlotte Hornets. I was just wondering if that surprised you, what you thought of the job Borrego had done in Charlotte these past couple of years.
It didn't surprise me. Like, anytime a team disappoints in two straight playoff with an asterisk play-in situations, I guess, like, the coach is going to be the first guy to roll, especially if there isn't an easy answer on the roster to trade. And so I'm not surprised that he's gone. I don't like it. Like, I think this is more of a personnel issue than anything for Charlotte. Like, they just don't have a strong defensive infrastructure. And James Borrego tried. Like, no team in the NBA ran more zone than James Borrego over the last 2 years. Like, they've jumped it up. And not just a 2-3. Like, they're pressing into a zone. They did a lot of funky stuff on defense to hide the fact that they did not have an elite rim protector. They did not have elite point of attack defenders. And even with the guys that have the wing, like, Cody Martin is a good defender. If Cody Martin is your best perimeter defender, you have a problem. Yeah. And if you're relying on Kelly Oubre to supplement that, he can do some good things for you on the ball.
Yep.
Run a screen or two and see if he can stay attached. It's a problem. And I'm not sure what you wanted James Borrego to do with that. You don't want your team to get embarrassed in playing. Like, losing in the play-in is one thing. Getting embarrassed in two straight outings, like, that's, I understand why that's a bad thing to hit. But give him some defensive pieces to work with. Like, Charlotte has gotten better in his tenure. Your young guys have gotten better. And so I say this just purely from the on-court. Like, if there's behind-the-scenes stuff or there's player X doesn't like Borrego and that's a big thing, like, obviously you just have to – you have to curate your roster and build it from there. But strictly from what we saw on the court from him, Borrego shouldn't be out of this job.
Yeah, I agree. Last question. Based on what you've seen in the first week of the playoffs, what potential second-round matchup gets you most excited?
Ooh, Heat Sixers. Online toxicity plus really good basketball. Like, I think that's it doesn't get much better than that. That looks like that's where it's going. We're going to see, is Jimmy Butler against Philly? It's Bam and Joel Embiid. It's James Harden. Like, we've seen Trae Young get Kyle Lowry, Caleb Martin, PJ Tucker, Jimmy Butler, Gabe Vincent. James Harden's going to see a host of bodies, which means Tyrese Maxey's probably also going to get a host of bodies. Like, that's just going to be a fun chess match. And these teams are just, the team fan bases do not like each other. And so I can just imagine what the whistle is going to be like. Jimmy Butler likes to get to the line quite a bit. We know what Joel Embiid and James Harden can do. That's just going to be an annoying skill bloodbath of a series. I'm ready for that one.
This is going to be great. Well, thanks, Nikias. Thank you for answering our questions. That was awesome. We are now going to do a playoff draft. So this is after the first week of the playoffs. See how we feel about teams in terms of who we think is going to win the championship. So how this works, this is a snake draft. It's me, Nikias, and Andrew. Nikias, you can go first. You get the first pick and the sixth pick, or you could go second. You could go third. I'm going to let you pick where you want to go in this playoff draft. What would you like?
Actually, let me go third.
Okay. So Nikias has chosen third because this is a snake draft, which means Nikias will get the third and fourth pick. Now, Andrew, I'll let you pick next since I'm being nice. Where would you like to go?
I'll go first.
Okay, Andrew. So Andrew's going to go first. I will go second, and Nikias will go third. So I have shared my screen. You guys can see it. You can see the teams that are available. We're only going to do four rounds, so we're only going to pick 12 of the 16 teams. It will mean that we leave four teams off. I have an idea on three of them, but I'm interested to see who the fourth one is. So Andrew, why don't you start us off right now, a week into the playoffs? Who, if you had to pick a team to win the NBA championship, who would you go with?
Still give me Phoenix.
I still think Phoenix. Wow.
Yeah. I still like the Suns. Their depth is there. I think that they'll get past New Orleans and hopefully have a little bit of downtime for Booker to get back. And if he's back and healthy, to me, they're the strong favorite.
Okay. Well, this is an easy pick for me. I'm so glad they fell to two. I am going with the Golden State Warriors. We're now up 3-0. I still feel like there's more ceiling there for Golden State as Steph slowly works his way back. So I'm just feeling really good. We got a healthy Draymond. Like, everything seems to be clicking right now. Yes, Denver maybe isn't like the best matchup to reveal what flaws might be there. But I have a feeling this series is going to end quickly. And if I can get a little help from the Wolves to push that Memphis series a little bit longer, I'm going to feel even better. So I'm going with Golden State, which means Nikias, you now have the third and fourth picks. Who would you like?
This actually set up pretty nicely. I was hoping that Phoenix was going to slide because I do think they're going to be able to get past New Orleans, and I think they'll be okay later on in the postseason. But I'm cool. One, let me go ahead and take Boston.
Okay.
The best defense in the NBA right now, as Jason Tatum has ascended, as Jaylen Brown is playing well, Marcus Smart playing well, like, they just have the juice on both ends of the floor right now. And as for the next pick, give me I'll go with Milwaukee still.
Wow, Milwaukee. Still have faith.
I do still have faith. And it's also a little bit of strategy on my end. Because if Milwaukee's able to get by Chicago, they're going to face Boston. I'm not sure what the status of Robert Williams is. If he'll be back for that second round series or when he'll come back. And I do think Giannis still poses such a unique threat to Boston with their interior defense. Mm-hmm. Especially with Robert Williams out. Like, Giannis can still eat. And if they do get healthy, like, I still like them in the East. So I'll go Milwaukee and Boston. So I'm kind of hedging my bets here. It's fine.
Ooh, so I could go with Memphis, which if I think Memphis is going to win their first round series, it would guarantee me a spot in the Western Conference Finals because I already have Golden State. So that'd be nice for me. I think I'm going to go Philly, though. I'm going to go Philly because they're up 3-0. I'm feeling confident they're going to second round. I like the matchup with – I spelled Philadelphia wrong. I like the matchup with Miami. And with the way things are going with the Bucks right now, I just feel like the path to the finals has kind of set up nicely for Philly. I mean, I was most worried about this first round series with Toronto going into it. And now that they've proven themselves there, if we see an improved Harden the rest of the playoffs, which we, like, as Nikias mentioned, we still don't really know in terms of his scoring ability. I feel pretty good about Philly. So I'm going to go Philly with my second pick. Now, Andrew, you get two picks in a row. Who would you like? Still a lot of good names on the board.
Mm-hmm. You fools. You absolute fools. Give me the Miami Heat.
There you are.
Everybody's just sleeping on the Heat all year long. Still sleeping. This team is strong. They've got, obviously, you got Heat culture working for you. You've got a champion in Kyle Lowry leading the way. They've got good depth. They've got shooting. I think this Miami Heat team. I don't know if we're just bored with them. Like, what's the deal? Like, why do we think that no one talks about this Miami Heat team? They're just maybe not as fun to talk about. I don't know. What is it?
It's, I'm not sure why they don't get talked about a bunch. Like, full disclosure, I was hoping Miami's going to slide. I was trying to decide, like, is Milwaukee going to slide more or Miami's going to slide more? Uh-huh. So I'm kind of upset that Miami slid. There was a team I was eyeballing. But I think my hesitation with Miami has been, okay, what does the late game offense look like?
Sure.
Because Jimmy Butler did not have a good clutch year this year. And it's a lot of reliance on Tyler Hero as a shot creator. And he can do it. Mm-hmm. He's going to win Sixth Man of the Year because of what he's meant to this Heat team offensively. But when it's late in the game, Milwaukee's running Chris Giannis pick and roll. Boston's going with Jason Tatum. Philadelphia can dump it to Embiid and force a double team. Miami has Tyler Hero, or if there's a smaller guy on the court, Jimmy Butler post-ups, which can work, can get him to the free throw line, but what we've seen in the regular season has not been great. So that's kind of been the hang-up for me personally.
Yeah.
Overall, I don't get why you don't talk about this team, though, because they have blended schemes all year long offensively, defensively. If we talk about what Golden State and Boston could do, Miami switching, going zone, going drop, trapping out of stuff. They do everything you want defensively. And they've put Trae Young through the ringer through the first two games of this series. So they deserve your respect.
Yeah. Give me Memphis too.
Memphis. Okay.
Memphis. Yeah. Give me the Grizzlies. I know it's been a wild ride. That's been such a fun series so far. But I don't know. I can't. They're young, but I would not be surprised to see them in the Western Conference Finals. I would not be surprised. And they'll have a puncher's chance. You just never know what can happen once you get there. So, yeah, give me Memphis.
All right, I'm going to go with Brooklyn. Yes, they are down 2-0, but as I mentioned, these first two games have been super close. They've been super close. I mean, easily could be 1-1 in this series, and I still get KD and Kyrie, and they're going home. And who knows? Ben Simmons coming back for game four. Maybe that'll help. Maybe he'll play 15 or 20 minutes and do something. So I feel like there's room to grow here for the Brooklyn Nets pick. So that's an easy one for me. Nekias, you now get your final two picks.
Ah, well, this is fun now, isn't it? Okay. One, give me Dallas.
Yeah.
Because I think they are knocking Utah out of here. And if they are then going to be set up in the 4-5, in the 1-5 matchup, I think, with Phoenix, and they don't have Devin Booker, and they get Luka Doncic back.
Yeah.
That could get a little bit dicey. So I think I'm going Dallas there. And to close it out, I don't see it with Minnesota. Denver's pretty much done. I guess I go – sheesh, man, this is –
it's gotten thin pretty quick.
Gotten thin for real. I guess I'll go Chicago to close it out.
I felt like that was the last decent pick.
Yeah. I know. That's what I was looking at too.
Like if they are able to get past Milwaukee, that's gonna set them up with Boston, who, I mean, they switch a ton, really good defense, but in theory, Chicago has the shot makers to beat switches. And if it's Brooklyn somehow, like I'm not trusting. Well, Brooklyn's defense has been better, but I don't know. Like, that could be a shot maker's fest. And if you do get a bad Kyrie series, or if you are able to junk it up and force turnovers against the half court attack, Chicago will run out. Like, that, I guess a pathway is there. I'm trying to talk myself into it a lot. this is why they're my fourth pick, but that, I think Chicago has the best pathway for a run.
Yeah, I think that was a strong final pick, because I'm going with the Pelicans purely based on the fact that they're the only one of these teams that is not down in their series currently. They're tied 1-1, and that alone is reason to pick them as my final pick.
I respect it.
My final pick will be the Toronto Raptors. Because
coming back from three down!
Doc Rivers might outdo himself. Who knows? It's been back 3-1. Let's see. Maybe Toronto's got it in them. If anybody's got it in them, I think it's Toronto of the remaining teams.
So that means our final picks. Andrew took Phoenix, Miami, Memphis, Toronto. I've got Golden State, Philly, Brooklyn, New Orleans, and Nekias went Boston, Milwaukee, Dallas, Chicago. And that wraps up our first playoff draft.
Sweet. Nekias, thank you so much for coming on the show. Go listen to the Dunker Spot podcast. Go check out basketballnews.com as well. Thanks so much for coming on, man.
Thanks for having me, guys.
All right, and our next guest is Dane Moore from the Dane Moore Podcast covering the Minnesota Timberwolves. Dane was in the building last night for Game 3. Dane, how's it going?
It's going good, man. I thought this would be a more pleasant Timberwolves conversation that two separate times during that game, but here we are. I have this, a lot of radio show hits today. I'm trying to not be super depressing, so let's do it.
Well, hey, let's start positive. You were in that building. How did that environment, especially in the first half, compare to other Wolves games you've been in?
Honestly, it was bad. I was really disappointed. I was in Memphis and like, so game one, you know, it was pretty lively there. But game two in Memphis just felt like a well-attended regular season game, you know?
Yeah.
And so I was like, man, it's going to be like back in Minneapolis, the Thursday night, the weekend, they play Thursday, and then Saturday night is like a 9 p.m. start time. And I was like, okay, like Target Center is probably going to be pretty tuned up. And I don't know if it's an early start time, but it was just kind of like, it didn't have that playoff energy that I at least, maybe I was expecting too much. I mean, you know, with the Timberwolves, this is only like second playoff appearance in 20 years. So I thought it would be wild, but it was, I mean, it's not like there weren't fans there. It wasn't what you think it would be.
Really?
Yeah.
That's interesting, because on the TV, like, it felt like people were comparing it to the old Thunder crowds, like the KD Russ crowds.
It'll and be through like the TV,
it felt so loud. Yeah. Okay.
Saturday, they'll be drunk. It'll be it's 9 p.m. start.
let's stay a little positive here still. In game two, Memphis sat Steven Adams the entire second half and seemed to have found something without him in the lineups. Adams was on the bench to start game three, but unlike the second half of game two, Minnesota was able to jump out to a massive lead. What are some of the adjustments made from game two to game three that allowed the Wolves to get out early with Adams off the floor?
Yeah, well, it was so. In theory, right, you take Adams off the floor so as to play Kyle Anderson to give you more of, if you're the Grizzlies, to give you an advantage guarding Karl Anthony Towns. And while clearly to some degree that worked, Kat just wasn't shooting. He only shot four shots in the whole game, which that's a separate topic we can get to. But I thought why it was working so well in the first half and while you saw the Wolves' lead blow up to 26 is it gave D'Angelo Russell a hiding spot on defense, right? Like he had to be guarding Desmond Bane in games one and games two, which just puts, you know, more of a physical onus on him on both sides of the floor. And D'Lo had a terrible first and second game, but in game three gets a chill off ball away from Kyle Anderson. And sure enough, he was kind of driving the Wolves offense that whole first half as they blew up the big lead. So that was the Grizzlies. It's like, it's weird. It's one of those counters where I think you can make an argument that it worked for the Grizzlies, but at the same time, it did open up some stuff for the Wolves where it got D'Lo going. There was also times where Kat did pick apart the Kyle Anderson double teams that were coming. So mm-hmm. I don't know. It's just one of those bizarre games where I think the Wolves did stuff well. They just choked twice for extended periods of time. So I thought it went both ways.
So eventually that game turns. The Grizzlies end the game on a 50-13 run. What do you think were the major issues for the Wolves during that fourth quarter period?
Just cap foul trouble anxiety. I mean, it's pervasive. It's happened all season, right? Where it's not just this idea of cat foul trouble and literally needing to go sit on the bench. It's that even when he's on the floor and it's the fourth quarter and he has four, there's this anxiety about him picking up another foul that will have to resend him to the bench. And that obviously hurts them defensively because now he can't be as aggressive, you know, guarding Jaws, Jaw goes to the rim. But on the other side of the floor, like, I don't think enough people know nationally that, like, Kat's offensive game this year has not been shooting threes. Like, he has not been an aggressive three-point shooter. He plays more like Giannis now, where his whole game is sort of like pump and go to the rim. But again, if he's got four or five fouls and he's a big 6'11 dude, pump and go into the rim is he starts getting afraid that's going to lead to charges on the other side of the ball. So it just kind of has this like snowball downhill thing with Kat and foul trouble that produces this anxiety, I think, that is pervasive across the team, and they just kind of get stuck in it.
That's interesting you brought that up, because when I was coming up with trivia questions, it was kind of the first time I noticed how much his three-point attempts had dropped from like a few years ago when he was taking over 8 a game.
Yeah.
I just like hadn't realized that yet.
Yeah, no, I mean, well, so Gerson Rosas comes in 20, they fire Tibbs 2018-19 season. Gerson Rosas comes in and he's like, he's not only the GM, he's total like puppet master. They're doing every single thing he wants. And he decides want to go super small, like doesn't believe in power forwards. We're going to play fast and we're just going to shoot so many threes. And Cat just sat up top, like 10 threes per 100 possessions for 2 years in a row. And then Rosas is out. You bring in Finch, and Finch has started using him on all three levels. But the most, like, I don't know, when I think about this year, the biggest image I will have of the Timberwolves offense is like Cat with the ball up top, like pick and pop, catches the ball, pump, sees how the defense reacts to that, and goes to the basket. I mean, he lost a bunch of weight in the offseason. He's definitely faster this season, and he prefers to go to the basket and try and put it on somebody's head rather than taking the threes. I think he got bored with threes, honestly.
Towns took 4 shots in last night's game and not had great. More fouls than field goals made for the second straight game. After that game, Cat responded with a next question when John Kay asked him about his 4 shots. Tell us, like, what do you think about how he responded, and then tell us about your follow-up.
You have to frame it in a way where it doesn't make him sound as bad. I think it doesn't matter whoever was going to ask him about his shot total the first time through, he was going to be short and dismissive of. Of course. He's probably really mad he only shot 4 shots in that game. He's never shot 4 shots in a basketball game in his career. He has been in foul trouble every game of his career for the most part, and he's never only shot 4 shots in a game.
Yeah.
So, whatever. It was that way. But this has happened all year where teams, the best way to guard the Wolves, obviously, this season, and it blows my mind whenever teams don't, is putting a small on Cat and bringing a roving double over what off of Vanderbilt. It's very obvious. Some teams didn't do it, and I don't know what the hell they were thinking. But this year, when you do that, that's the best way to go against the Wolves. So you just see Memphis leaning into that. And what Carl has said when that's happened at other times this season is, I'm cool with being a decoy if it gets other guys going. So that was the way I put it to him after the game. And he was like, I don't think it was, he basically, that gave him a little bit of an out. And to some extent too, he's right. It was working. They got two 20 plus point leads doubling him. Pull him out one step, square up, pass. You should have Malik Beasley in the corner for a three. Jaden McDaniels above the break for an open three. It's like, these are generating good looks when he's a quote unquote decoy. But at the same time, like, and he knows this, like making the quote unquote right play is not the right play every single time. When you're the best player on a playoff team in a playoff game, like, you need to make the quote-unquote wrong play, not make the pass, and find a way to score without picking up an offensive foul. And that's what Carl definitely did not do in that game last night. It's not the end of the world to have a low shot total. The Wolves have won games this season when Cats had a low shot total. But there was times in that game where they needed him to be more than a decoy and pass the ball out. They needed him to take over in the ways that the other superstar centers in this league certainly would have. That goes very different if that's Nikola Jokic, Joel Embiid, Giannis Antetokounmpo in those situations. They just need him more.
So you brought up kind of like there's a responsibility on Cat's part to be more aggressive. What about the flip side about the other players on the Wolves getting Cat the ball? Because that seems to be an issue as well.
What's your suggestion? I'm dead serious. Like, what would you do? Carl doesn't do his work early to get post position. He never has. So, I mean, I could stand there on the perimeter and be like, all right, Alex, post up. If you don't post up and do your work early to get down there, like, a post up's not good there. Mm-hmm. So you're going to want to go pick and pop him and Ant, him and D'Lo, right? That's another one of those options. But if you're in foul trouble or if you don't want to drive to the basket, then you need to pick, pop, and shoot. Carl shot 1-3 in that game. Yeah. I mean, that's on him, right? He got the ball in those situations. His teammates, the best thing they can do for him is make those threes when he kicks out. It's not like, I don't think Chris Finch isn't being creative with the ways in which they give it to Cat. Cat needs to grab the ball when he's got a guy switched on him at the nail, square up, and score. That's what he did during the season once he got the switch. Like, he didn't do it in this game. So, I don't know. Best thing his teammates can do is make shots, because that'll force them to respect them more. I don't think there's like a, there's not like a button they're not pressing. Carl plays all over the floor, and it didn't work anywhere. So,
So that kind of leads into my next question, which, are there any obvious adjustments to be made for the Wolves going into game four? Or is this more of an issue of the team just needing to execute their game plan, settle down? Because they seem to be pretty evenly matched with Memphis.
I actually think it's a great matchup for the Wolves. I mean, as we kind of were doing the whole like dance around the 6-7 seed, you know, for the past couple months, I was like, I mean, get Memphis, like whatever it is, like get Memphis. You don't want Golden State in that. Like, they don't have a matchup for Carl if Carl isn't in foul trouble. Like, if he isn't all in his head and afraid to drive and play his game, Steven Adams can't guard him. Like, okay, cool. Xavier Tillman, you can make a couple clips of him guarding Cat, you know, on Twitter, but he can't guard Cat for 48 minutes. Like, if Cat's not in foul trouble, that's the adjustment. Don't get in foul trouble. Be the best player on the floor. Like, it's not like Ja is, I mean, he was great in the fourth quarter, but I don't know. He's not like some unstoppable force in this series. Like, the adjustment is to play better and to like not lose your head to the emotion of the game. I mean, it's really, I don't know. Like, we could talk like X's and O's adjustments. It's tricky with this team always that they play Jared Vanderbilt, who can't shoot, so his guy doesn't guard him and then doubles Cat. But the Wolves don't have other power forwards on their team, because, again, Gerson Rosas did not believe in that position, so they don't have big players. So what do you do? Like,
yeah,
I don't know. You want to play, you want to play Jaden McDaniels at the four? Well, okay, he's got to guard Brandon Clark. Like, that's going to be offensive rebounds all day. Like, they haven't had a professionally built roster the entire season. They've had a professionally talented team with Cat and Ant and D'Lo, and they found, like, they found a bench rotation. Like, they do weird stuff with, like, Jordan McLaughlin plays, and that's, like, the fourth point guard who plays. And it's there's all this stuff, but this roster coming into the season, a joke in terms of balance. There isn't, right. I mean, look at it. Look at it next to Memphis. Look at all the big people on their team, and then look at the big people on the Timberwolves team. I mean, Naz Reid is the second biggest guy on this team. That dude is skinny and not tall. I don't know. It's just like, so you need to lean into your speed and your strengths if you're the Wolves, because you can't really, like, you can't do what Memphis has done and been like, okay, Steven Adams, you're just out for the series. Here's three other big guys we can throw at them. You know, the Wolves don't have that depth.
Well, hopefully, you know, you mentioned Saturday night. Maybe the Wolves crowd shows up big time. The players are inspired. They can get a win, because they could easily tie this series up, send it back to Memphis for game five. Like, this series, as you mentioned, has been so close. It seems like a good matchup.
For sure. I mean, so think about what we'd be talking about if they would have kept one of the 20-plus point wins, of the multiple 20-plus point wins. We'd be like, okay, Wolves are, they got it.
Right, yeah.
Spring is the best time to add new challenges to your training, just in time for summer and warmer days. I know I'm looking outside right now. Sun's out, birds are chirping. It's time to start getting outside. I know that I like to get outside and play basketball with my kids. And honestly, I need to get into a fitness routine in order to keep up with these guys. And Peloton is there for me. Peloton's varying class lengths were designed with your training plan in mind. Personalize your workout, whether you'd like to add a 10-minute core session at the end of your strength class, or take a 60-minute power zone ride to increase your endurance. Peloton classes are designed to help focus on your needs and goals. Peloton's classes were made to challenge you. There are a variety of classes like boot camps, boxing, full body strength, or marathon training, all created to grow your skills or push you to improve in what you're already excelling in. Peloton's program and instruction push you to be your best. Their expert coaches and nonstop vibes will push you to new levels of strength and endurance, keeping you on your toes while giving you the professional coaching you need. Peloton has everything you need to get you where you're going. Whether you prefer to run indoors, row or ride at home, or strength train at the gym, Peloton has something for you. Get your head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
All right, well, it is now time to play Andrew versus the Beat. Now, Dane, how this works is a trivia show. Andrew goes against a beat writer for an NBA team. I've come up with 8 questions about the Wolves. So you're going to give me a number between 1 and 8. It'll correspond to a question. If you get it right, you'll get points. If you get it wrong, Andrew have a chance to steal for 1 point. Where would you like to start? Questions 1 through 8.
8.
Question number 8. Minnesota attempted over 41 three-pointers per game this season. There have only been 4 other NBA franchises who have attempted at least 40 three-pointers per game in a single season. How many can you name? Now, this one you could get 4 points on because I'm going to give you 1 point per correct answer. So that you just have to name me NBA franchises who have had at least one season where they attempted at least 40 three-pointers per game.
Houston. Do I have to give you that a year?
No. Okay. That is correct. That's for 1 point.
Utah this year, right?
That is correct for 2 points.
Could there be another Houston? Can that be one of the answers?
There are teams that had multiple years, and Houston was one of them.
I'm not mentally prepared for this. it wouldn't be Golden State. They shot a bunch of mid-range in the KD time, right? Is Golden State on there?
That is incorrect. That's why I thought this question would be tricky, because Golden State has never attempted more than 43 pointers per game. All right, Andrew, you have a chance. You could get 2 points here. You could tie it up if you can name the other 2 teams who have done it.
What about Charlotte?
Charlotte, that's a great guess, but it's wrong. Correct answers: Dallas did it, Portland. Pro and Trailblazers. Okay, Dane, you're up 2-0. Andrew, you have control of the board. Where would you like to go next?
Question number one.
Karl Anthony Towns scored 60 points in a March game against the Spurs, becoming the first Wolves player to score 60 and the first to have 2 50-point games. There are 4 other Timberwolves who have scored at least 50 points in a game. How many can you name? Now, another one where you could get 4 points, Andrew, because you're going to get 1 point per correct answer. So these are Minnesota Timberwolves who have scored 50 points in a game. There's 4 of them.
Corey Brewer.
That is correct for 1 point.
Okay. Gosh, there's like the best. I feel like it's like not the best guys.
It's not.
Maybe it is. Maybe it isn't. I can't. Oh, Dane just gave you a hint.
Yeah.
There's 0% Wally chance Zerbiak you're going to get this.
Wally Zerbiak, that is incorrect, Andrew. Dane, you have a chance to steal 3 points here.
Mo Williams.
Yes, for 1 point.
Mo Williams, no.
And then I would Kevin Love.
That is correct.
Oh, man.
Can you get the final one to get to 5 points?
I don't have this one off the top of my head. I think we go back further into history, which is definitely out of my beat realm. J.R. Ryder.
J.R. Ryder. Would you believe the correct answer was Derrick Rose?
Oh, my God. I was at that game. God dang it.
Derrick Rose.
Oh, my God. That's so dumb. Oh, I'm mad.
Well, the good news is
that was Halloween 2018. Oh,
was it really?
Yes.
Oh, that must have been like one of the first games of the season. Okay, the good news, Dane, you're up 4-1, and you have control of the board.
Ouch.
How did I get Mo Williams, Derek, whatever? I'll do 7.
Okay. Now, before you answer, there's some extra instructions for the question. So, how many Timberwolves have made at least 1 All-NBA team? Now, before you answer, you get to choose who answers first. So you can let Andrew answer, and then you can go higher or lower. Or if you feel like you're pretty confident, you can answer first. The risk, of course, is Andrew might just get it right randomly.
3.
Okay, so Dane has guessed 3. Now, Andrew, would you like to go higher or lower than that?
I'll say lower.
Andrew says lower. So you think it was 2 or 1 or 0, perhaps? Well, what if I told you it was 5. KG, Sam Cassell, Cat, Jimmy Butler, and K-Love. So that is 2 points for Dane. Andrew,
wow,
you're struggling right now.
Sam Cassell. I did not remember Sam Cassell All-NBA.
You don't remember the 2004 All-NBA ballot?
All right. Was he third team, I guess?
Yes.
Actually, I think it might have been second. I forget. I need to go.
Oh, they did. They
I mean, I don't need to go look. I'm not going to.
Yeah, they did. Yeah, they were good. They were good that year.
Okay, Andrew, you're down 6-1, but you do have control of the board.
This is bad. Number two.
Number two. Anthony Edwards averaged 21.3 points per game this season, becoming only the 14th player to average at least 20 points per game before turning 21 years old. Who was the first player in NBA history to achieve that goal? So the first under 21 player to average 20 points or more per game in a season.
Oh, boy. Was it Kobe?
It was not! Dane, you have a chance to steal for 1 point.
Well, I feel like this is a trickier question than my brain is going with.
Yeah.
Okay, I want to say LeBron, but I will say Moses Malone.
Moses Malone! A great guess, but it is incorrect. Andrew, you're going to be very mad at yourself. Who'd you collect all that peanut butter for?
Shaq.
It was Shaquille O'Neal.
Really? Ouch.
Not going to explain the peanut butter thing?
That's painful. When I was in college, Shaq came to Oklahoma City and did a peanut butter food drive here for Feed the Children. And the person who brought the most peanut butter got to meet Shaq, fly out to Phoenix for a Suns game. And I collected 535 jars of peanut butter and was the winner. So,
you got to go hang out with the big Shaq tie.
I did. The big Shaqtus.
He leveraged all his possessions to get more peanut butter.
I did. I found out that if you're looking for the cheapest peanut butter, it's Aldi sells the cheapest peanut butter. I would actually, people would give me peanut butter. They'd drop it off my doorstep. I'd take it back to Walmart, get the money, go, and then I would go buy out Aldi of all their peanut butter.
One of the Wolves beat writers this year brought Anthony Edwards a case of chunky peanut butter and gave it to him at the press conference because he said, he said he'd never had chunky peanut butter before, so we're basically the same.
Okay, Dane, you're still up 6-1, commanding lead, and you have control of the board.
I'll take three.
Question number three. Anthony Edwards scored 36 points in game one, his first playoff game. Did you know there are only two other 20-year-olds in NBA history who scored 30 or more in their playoff debut? Both were Eastern Conference point guards from the early 2010s. Can you name them? And I'm going to give you 1 point per correct answer.
Derrick Rose.
That is correct. Can you get the other one, though?
Eastern Conference early 2010s. Allen Iverson?
That is incorrect. Andrew, you have a chance to steal.
Oh, I don't know that he was. I think he was too old for this. I thought I had an answer, but I don't think it's right now.
Oh, no.
Oh, 2010s. Anyway. Why did I say Iverson? That was stupid.
Well, I glossed over it. You already got a point, you know. Can't be too mad.
Was Wade too old? Was Dwayne Wade too old?
Is that your guess?
That's my guess. He's too
old. Yes, he was too old. Correct answer. Brandon Jennings scored 34.
Oh, yeah, his first playoff appearance. I remember that now.
All right, Andrew, back to you. The comeback starts now.
Oh, boy. Number four.
Number four. Who had the most dunks on the Timberwolves this season? Easy question. Easy question, Andrew. No. Just the most dunks.
Jared Vanderbilt?
That is correct! Wow. For 2 points. All right. So now it is, it's 7-3. Dane still doing pretty well and has control of the board.
Six.
All right. Why is the Timberwolves mascot named Crunch? Now, I'm going to give you five possible reasons. Only one of them is correct. Was he named after the idea of crunch time in a basketball game? Was he picked by the fans as part of a Name the Mascot contest? Was he named after the Crunch candy bar? Was he named by one of Glenn Taylor's children who wanted to name the mascot after the family dog? Or was he named after the Big Crunch, a hypothetical scenario for the ultimate fate of the universe?
I hope it's the last one.
Those answers are all so dumb. There's not a good answer available there.
One of them is right, apparently, based on an article from the Chicago Tribune I found from 1990.
1990? Okay, Glenn Taylor wasn't the owner then, so we've ruled out the child's dog.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
Crunch candy bar?
The game master has been figured out here.
Crunch candy bar? Is that why?
That is correct. It was named after the Crunch candy bar. There was this article about how the Wolves were trying to do branding with everything, and Nestle made like finger puppets of Crunch the Wolf and like sold them. I found one on eBay. You can still go get one if you want it.
How much?
They were very poor like back then.
$10.
Oh, $10.
All right, Andrew, you have this is maybe the worst you've ever been beaten. It's currently 9-3. However, you can make up a couple points to shrink that lead. Final question. There were 32-man lineups for the Wolves who played at least 500 minutes together this season. This player appears in four of the top five two-man lineups when sorted by net rating.
D'Angelo Russell.
That's correct, Andrew. A great finish, but you still lost convincingly. 9-5.
So D'Lo ended up there over because it was like... It was Vanderbilt for a while there at the beginning of the year, but it must have. I guess he played with them too. Their two man lineups up was so weird. Like you wouldn't find Cat or Edwards up there at all. It was all like Pat Bev, Vando, and D'Lo. Man, the Wolves had a really weird year. As far as who was playing? And, oh my god!
Oh, man. Go listen to the Dane Moore podcast if you're looking for a good Timberwolves listen. Honestly, if you're an NBA fan, it's a great listen anyway. So, Dane, thanks so much for coming on. And I have not had anybody beat me that bad in trivia all year, so thank you.
Well, I'd like to take credit, but I think you just got in foul trouble and, you know, lost your head. I don't think I played all that well.
Thanks, Dane.
All right, guys.
Thanks again to Nikias Duncan and Dane Moore for joining the podcast this week. We really appreciate all of you guys listening. If you could leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts for the Athletic NBA show, if you cite the Slam and Jam on your review, we will read the review on the show. We've done that a bunch of times throughout this season. Do that for next week, and we will certainly mention your review on the show. Hope you guys have a great weekend. Enjoy the playoffs, and we will talk to you guys again next week.